Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 9 of 4Js and a Comic. Before we jump into our review this week, we first have a special announcement from a special guest. Marcus, take it away.
Hi, my name is Marcus. I'm the creator of a comic book called Mallow Man, and I'm currently working on the issue 5 and the trade paperback that's collecting the first 5 issues for my comic book. I went on Kickstarter.com and I've started a project for the next 20 days, and I'm trying to get it funded so that I can print it and bring it all to all my fans out at the cons. If you go to Kickstarter.com, just type in Mallow Man, and if you are willing to pledge, that'd be fantastic, or even share it on Facebook or any of your other social medias. I would really appreciate it.
We'll definitely put a link in the show notes. Now, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with Mallow Man, can you tell us a little bit about Mallow Man?
Well, Mallow Man is a crime-fighting marshmallow who has to save the world with his partner Bacon Boy.
Who is also a piece of bacon, yes.
All of the characters in my comic book are food, surprisingly enough, from a comic creator who's diabetic. And
and they live in Pantry City.
They live in Pantry City, exactly. So it's fitting, right? I mean, that's where the food lives. I had this wild idea. It's not a spoiler because it's not going to happen. At one point, the original ending to this whole story was just going to be that I end up showing up in the last book and just eat everybody.
That's awesome.
And that was going to be the end.
Can you please do like a bonus issue? Just like 3 pages.
The last line has to be, it's the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man.
I Google myself a lot. And whenever I type in Mallow Man, just to see what comes up, he's my biggest competitor. Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. I got to find that guy.
That's right.
All over the place.
I'm telling you, man.
I Google myself a lot too, but well, that's a different story for a different podcast.
So Mallow Man is in Pantry City with his psychic Bacon Boy.
Yeah, he's an ex-FBI agent. He worked for the Food Bureau of Investigation.
Or the FBI.
He left the FBI to pursue bounty hunting. And in the beginning of our story, he is called upon again to help stop a mysterious evil who's trying to take over the world.
With their legion of hot dog monsters.
Dog troops, yes.
The dog troops.
Mm-hmm. The dog troops.
So I can
Nobody
jump
likes a sausage party.
So now, I mean, several of us, or all of us here have read some, if not all, of Marcus's comics so far, right? What do you guys think of the comic?
I think it is the quintessential indie comic book.
Hey, that's my quote.
What a great, great line.
Yeah, a little while ago, we actually did a full official review on the Geek Life podcast over at pandamanga.com, and Justin was there. And I did say that it is the quintessential indie comic book. And what I meant by that elaboration is that it is what I imagine in my mind when I think of an independent comic. It's very entertaining, very funny, creative, definitely ideas that you wouldn't ever expect to be in mainstream in any way, but it works really well. And, you know, just like anything independent, there are a couple rough edges, and that's perfectly acceptable and expectable. You know, Marcus is not working 16 hours a day slaving away for Marvel.
Those were intentional.
Right.
That's what I wanted.
It's all on purpose, yeah.
Yeah, but dude, you name the town. It's Pantry City. There's so much clever.
Oh, it's so damn fun. I mean, that's what I meant by that.
Is the rough part of town called the lunchbox?
It is now.
And you should have Hell's Kitchen.
Exactly.
It would fit.
I can't believe I haven't made the sausage party joke yet. So thank you for that. You're now a contributing writer.
So, yeah, I mean, long story short, it's a really hilarious comic. We really have enjoyed, what is it, there's 4 issues out right now?
There's 4
Number
issues
5
out
is
right
coming
now.
Out soon. You can get all of them at Waterfront Comics.
I hear the tones on issue 5 are going to look fantastic.
Oh, I've heard that too, somewhere. Yeah, it's actually really cool because it's black and white with screen tones. And the screen tones in the first couple issues are a little non-traditional, but it's really cool to see a screen-toned independent comic because most independent comics are either just black and white or color. It's not real common to see screen tone independent comics, at least in my experience. It's kind of fun to see that style. So, yeah. So, dude, Marcus, we're excited. So go to Kickstarter.com
and search for Mallow Man.
All right.
There you can see the fun little video I made for my first Kickstarter pledge where I was actually able to raise the funds to print issue 1. From there, I printed issue 1. I sold it at cons. I made money, and then I printed issue 2. And then I did it again. I printed issue 3 and then issue 4. And the money's been serving all along until now that I'm on issue 5. It's a 36-pager instead of a 24, but I want to charge the same thing that I charged for my first 4 issues. And the trade paperback is going to cost significantly more because it's the collection of all of the different comics. So that's why I'm trying to kickstart more money.
Are there any backer rewards in particular that you want to shout out with? And anything that you think is really super awesome?
I love the idea of selling my artwork, the original pages of the book. And so those are all cool. At the $100 level. There's one thing in particular that I put pretty high up there. Just in case anyone's a collector of artifacts, it's the $5,000 level, there's a small little book that I did all the thumbnails for every single page in the entire book in. And I've been carrying around this book with me like for years and years before I even started drawing the actual pages. And it's where my ideas hit the page for the first time.
That's pretty cool.
Wow.
Nice. Awesome. Dude, well, thanks for coming on and letting us know about the Kickstarter.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. At what level, before we go, what level was the foot massage?
For you, Justin?
Yeah.
That's the Unimita $1 level. Just for you.
Yes. You just got $365, baby.
Yeah, careful what you offer, man. Awesome, dude. So, yeah, so Kickstarter.com, look for Mallow Man. And there'll be two up there. One of them will be fully backed, and the other one will be in process. So make sure to click on it and throw my man Marcus some cashola and get this next one out. It's a really great comic book, and you guys should. The world will be a better place if you help support it.
That's it. That is what they're saying.
That it is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. They as in me.
Yeah. Yes, it is NSA free.
Awesome, dude.
Help Mallow Man make the world a better place.
That's right.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you, Marcus. Now, getting started, tonight we're going to be discussing the works of Kurt Busiek. And I love the comic Astro City. It's been coming out now for about 15 years on and off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And this was 94 was the ones that we reviewed.
Just started a new run
of on Vertigo Comics. It's like the fifth publisher that it's gone through. And
it's an enduring comic. Yeah.
And before that, kind of what I consider Astro City Zero was a series called Marvels that came out in 93 that won numerous awards and kind of launched the careers of both Kurt and his collaborator, Alex Ross, who went on to bigger things, most namely the DC Comics series Kingdom Come, which we'll probably be reviewing down the road.
It's awesome. Looking forward to that. It's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Is Alex Ross Planet X also?
Yes. Earth X, and Paradise X and all that. So tonight would have been Jack Kirby's 96th birthday. So it's fittingly enough we're doing Marvels, which a good portion of it was influenced by his works when he relaunched Marvels.
Yeah.
When Marvels first came out in 93, comics at the time were about $1.25 cover price. When these came out, they were $6 each.
Damn.
So, which would be like an equivalent now of like $15 for each comic when they came out. And at the time, I was a student, had limited income for, you know, comics and, you know, incidental expenses like that. But I still bought it because, you know, I flipped through it. And your
jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, and it was like, wow, this is pretty damn amazing.
Yeah, seeing Alex Ross, like, paint every single page.
And the books themselves, when they came out, they didn't look like a comic. They were on, like, super heavy glossy paper.
Really?
And then the outer cover was like a clear acetate cover that went around it and that had the logo. So you'd open it up and then you'd see the Alex Ross.
Do you still have your old ones?
I have them somewhere.
I'd love to see
them. Yeah, I was talking to John Foltz. He says that he has them, like, readily available. He had just pulled them out and read them a couple of weeks ago.
Awesome.
So he was supposed to bring them by, but I think he'll bring them by Friday. So
cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. That's awesome.
Look, like I said, it was $6 at the time. So, you know, it was equivalent to like 5 regular comics.
But at least it felt different.
Yeah. I mean, and to be honest with you, a lot of the comics I bought in 1994, I have no idea about rereading them. But this one, you know, is one that I've revisited many, many times.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that quality over quantity cut type thing. So I gave the guys the 1995 trade paperback to review. It's been reprinted, you know, in different trades over the years. The first was a deluxe graffiti designs, like $70 hardcover back when nothing got hardcovers.
Wow, that's awesome.
So I have that. And then the standard $20 trade came out in 95, which was one of the few times when the trade was actually cheaper than buying the comics back then.
Yeah, right? That's funny.
Downstairs, that came out about 8 years ago, is the 10th anniversary edition that we have up here that has the story plus about another like 150 pages of script pages, their pitches. This is like the version to get if you absolutely love the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, there's, you know, the 2008 printing, which is the one that, you know, the regular trade paperback we have downstairs. So that being said, let's get into actually talking about the story. One of the things I didn't like how they did in the trade was after issues 1 through 4, which were the main story, came out, it was so popular that they did a zero issue that had, you know, kind of like a pitch story that got it rolling, which was the origin of the Human Torch, the original Human Torch from 1939.
So that wasn't chronologically what came out first.
No. And it, they always put it in the front of the start of the books, and it doesn't match the tone of the rest of the series.
Yeah, it follows a different character.
Yeah, and it even has like a whole different tone to it. And when you read that first and then you go into the main story, I find it a little jarring at first. So getting into the main story revolves around the life of a photographer named Phil Sheldon. When we first are introduced to him, he's probably early 20s, and it's set in 1939, the year that the first Marvel Comics number one came out with the origin of the original Human Torch and Namor. And through the story, we get to see how these events happen to every man. So the first story, it starts out, you know, set in the 30s and goes from there. So what were your guys' take on the first issue?
We're talking issue zero?
Issue one.
Issue one. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sheldon wants to go to the UK because the war's going on, or the war's starting to happen. And there's like nothing going on in the United States, right? So he wants to go kind of go where the action is. Mm-hmm. And then the Human Torch gets introduced right around the same time that Namor kind of comes into the world. And I was really confused again about, like, who's the good guy? Who's a bad guy? Are either of them good or bad? Why are they fighting all over the city? Like, what's the point of this? But it gives you a sense of, interestingly enough, like how different technology is today versus what it was back in the day, where like if you wanted to go see something, you had to get your ass over there to go see it. You know, they're sort of clamoring all over the city to find stuff. And
it's brilliant to have the main protagonist be a newspaper photographer,
right?
Because then more than anybody, more than an actual just normal journalist, being a photojournalist, you have to be there. You yeah. have to catch the images. You have to actually be there when it's happening.
Right, or you miss yeah. it.
And
right.
there's some spot where he's literally feet from them as they're battling.
Yeah, and he comes away injured, loses an eye from it.
Yeah. Right. It was that's when he was on the roof, I think.
Yeah,
right?
He gets up
to the roof. What was interesting was like, this is the first time that you have the perspective of them smashing into a bridge and knocking, like, the, you know, destroying the train tracks, and then all the traffic and, you know, sort of congestion and mayhem that causes.
Because the comic normally follows a battle raging through a city, destroying things as you go, and it follows mm-hmm. the heroes and right. the villains in from the middle of the battle, right? And in this, you've got a person who's quite literally grounded, and Namor and Torch fly through and destroy and smash something, and off they go in a different direction, and Phil's there like, holy crap, and people are falling off of stuff. And I mean, I can remember the one where they... where I don't even know if it was in that particular fight, but there was one where it was like a subway train that was raised above the ground that got smashed, and people were like hanging out of it, and it's like it shows the aftermath, and there's such a kind of candid, sober
yeah, it is
sort
that
of thing.
Battle.
I mean, it's really cool.
Right. It's what it looks like from average, you know, the average Joe, the average
totally
guy.
Totally new
right?
perspective.
But there's other overarching themes that I think we'll probably get to later. I have a couple. I have three distinct overarching themes.
I'd be interested to hear what they are.
Because this guy, you know, he's not just sort of average Joe Q public. I mean, he has an insight. He has he can see the big picture, and he
and
asks
a unique insight because he's there so consistently in the middle of things
right.
that he can't help but wonder and ponder upon them. Instead of, I mean, because like we said earlier, the supers, the Marvels, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They come flashing through everybody's lives, and they're there and gone in a moment. And so most people have a very tenuous sort of perspective on them, and it kind of out of sight, out of mind a lot of the time. But with Phil, he's following them around so much that he starts to have a deeper understanding of what's going on and starts to wonder and ponder things.
Well, he becomes an insider.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it becomes a major, it has significant effect on his life, which I'll get to later.
The single biggest piece of his life.
Right.
What I liked in the first issue with the significance of the Marvels appearing was how small it made Phil Sheldon feel.
Yes.
Yeah. So much so that he calls off the engagement with his wife, or fiance in this case, because he doesn't feel that, you know, he's significant enough that...
Yeah, he can't protect her from the craziness going on.
It totally challenges his sort of traditional sensibilities of I'm the man of the house, I take care of you, I should be able to protect my family, and then these forces that are so far beyond any normal man come into the world, and they're right in his face, and he's taking pictures of them and seeing them destroy things and seeing them save people, and he's thinking to himself, in this new world with the Marvels, where do I stand? Where, how can I possibly say, you're my wife and my children, and I will protect you?
Because how do I compete with that?
Yeah, right? These things, well, not even compete, but there's crime and trouble in the world, but, you know, hopefully as a husband, you're imagining that you could, at least in some capacity, defend your family. But with these sort of forces in the world, you're hopelessly outclassed.
Right.
You know, and so in the face of these sort of powerful beings being out in the world, it's like, if they ever happen to cross the path of your family, you have no capacity to be able to defend them. And I think that was a big part of him not wanting to get married, along with him feeling sort of belittled, you know, somehow.
I mean, imagine tomorrow we find out that there's a species among us that usurps us in every possible way. What it is you've been removed from the top of sort of the evolutionary food chain.
Not the alpha predator anymore.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, it's getting cut off at the knees in a lot of ways. And that's really represented very well here, because in every other time you read a comic, you know, where you're looking at the superhero and stuff, and it's always like, oh, he saved us. And oh, how wonderful. But what you never really get out of it is how incredibly fragile that makes us as, you know, and this is during, I think it's safe to say this is happening during sort of like, you know, right after like the Industrial Revolution, right? Like, you know, it's the 30s, right before the Great War. And so
it's 1939. So the war in Europe has started.
Right.
And
we're just about to get into it.
Yeah. And the United States is just starting to come almost out of the Depression.
Yeah, they're starting to get a little more positive, feeling like they're kind of coming into their power again, and then whoosh, in come these Marvels, and by comparison, make everybody feel small.
Right, but let me just finish this thought. So here we are thinking, and this is, he's a photographer, so, you know, he knows these things, but here we are on the verge of things like rocketry and space flight, which is only a decade down the road,
sure,
or, you know, so we're on the verge. So we as a species are at the top of our game, and all of a sudden you're not anymore. You're infinitesimally small compared to these guys that can survive all of this. And I can imagine it's had significant impact.
It was interesting, I think, following Phil through all of these different stories and seeing him grow inside, because early on, it's almost kind of a petty reaction he has to them.
It's a young man's reaction.
He's threatened by them.
It's
somehow
a 20-year-old's reaction.
Right, exactly, exactly. And
he gets the same almost verbatim quote out of J. Jonah Jameson years and years later.
Well, poor Jameson never grew up.
Yeah, he's explaining kind of why he hates the Marvels so much.
Did you guys catch at the beginning it was J. Jonah Jameson that he was talking to?
Yes.
Oh, right, yeah. Right, yeah.
Someday I'll run the Bureau. Yeah, that was very interesting. I didn't catch that. That's great, Joe, that it's almost verbatim with Jonah later on. So
I even think he uses the same quote. You know, how's a man measure up to that?
Which is interesting, because in the middle of his rant of Spider-Man's terrible, blah, 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 and this is much later in the story, so we're jumping ahead, but just get it out of my head. It's interesting that it's almost like that small little bit of vulnerability, like how does a man stand up against that, sort of slipped out in the middle of his typical tirade about, oh, they're terrible and they're menaces. Man, how does somebody even stand up against that? And they're just murderers and murderers, you know? And it was just this like little moment of humanity. It was probably one of the most human moments in comics with Jameson.
Very much so.
Yeah, very, very cool.
So I actually have notes on that particular thing about, there's this overarching theme, which I have as in this particular series, the way that humans, or the way that sort of, you know, the everyman kind of treats the Marvels. And it's sort of along the lines of, you know, they take the Marvels for granted, and everybody is, there's very much this angry and accusatory sort of attitude towards them. And there's all these inquiries and there's all these trials, and there's this moment where the mayor is thinking about kicking him out of the city. And it turns out that sort of like one of the bad guys, you know, framed them really well. And yet they save hundreds of people, you know, and they do it without being asked. And it was like, the way that I saw it is, if I can cut them down to size to be more flawed like me, if I can take some of the specialness away from them, then it evens the leveling. It levels the playground a little bit, right? It gets us on an even play, like, field. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that, from an emotional perspective, is sort of what he was trying to convey, is that they're so grandiose, they're, you know, they're flawless, right? That in order for me to be able to have value in myself, you know, knowing all my flaws, I have to find flaws in you to make you less. You know, it's a valuation system, I think. That's kind of one of the things that I read through sort of.
Well, I mean, as humans, we good or bad, we tend to measure each other against, measure ourselves against those around us. And,
right.
You know, we all sort of have our understanding of like our place in the pack or our rung on the ladder. And all of a sudden the ladder got 300 more steps and those guys are standing at the top of it and everybody else feels so far away. You know, and it's like a totally blows the bell curve, really.
Interestingly enough, though, it's all internalized. Those guys, they don't see it at all.
They're just
what they do. No. You know, it's something they do. Okay. Somebody explain, please. What is going on with the Human Torch? And is it the Submariner?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So why are they fighting? I know at one point, like, the FBI captures one of Namor's guys, but...
The real story, you know, was in the comic that comic that came out. This is just...
Yeah, this all glosses over so many different stories.
And then in the appendix of this, they have, like, where the stories took place, if you wanted to look it up at the end. But basically... The Submariner and Human Torch in those early Marvel issues, whenever they would meet up, fire and water.
Okay.
They don't mix.
Right,
you know?
Right. Gotcha.
And Namor has traditionally always been a dick.
Okay.
And, you know, the Human Torch.
Well, he doesn't identify as human.
Yeah.
He's, you know, from.
He's an android.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
He later becomes the Vision.
He's an android?
The Human Torch.
No, Namor. Namor.
Namor is.
Yeah, he's half Atlantean.
He's half.
Mutant.
Yeah.
Right. And so he doesn't. But what I'm saying is that he doesn't identify as human. He doesn't feel like he's part of the surface dwelling human race. And
in fact, he looks down on them.
Right. But at the same time, not really accepted in Atlantis because he's half breed. Right. Or
more so. I mean, he's the prince.
Oh, okay,
so,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, he becomes the ruler of Atlantis, but. But so, I guess there are some looked down upon.
I just kind of remember him feeling like he's often sort of caught between rock and hard place.
Absolutely.
And very often has like lots of internal turmoil.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that. And so he's perpetually not happy. And a lot of the time, a lot of the stuff that goes on in here where he's at odds with humanity, because he's like, oh, you know, Namor's declared war on the entire planet, you know. It's typically because some human force or government somewhere along the line has messed with Atlantis.
Yeah.
And he's retaliating.
Right.
And they don't tend to explain all that, but that's pretty much what's going on every time.
Well, in my head, as I was visualizing what this was all about, it was all of these amazing stories that have been centralized around the superhero characters in their comic books. And then this writer takes it and says, okay, what would it be like living in that time with all of these things going on around you? And so I knew I wouldn't get some of it.
Yeah, getting only the half information that the news would have broadcast.
Yeah.
And this guy he's sort of, you know, he's a content generator. So he's right there in the thick of it.
As close as he can get.
But I think it dawns on me why, and I've not read any of, you know, the Submariner stuff, but I think the reason why he is such a jerk is probably because nobody ever capitalized on what his real superpower is, and that is the ability to hold his breath for extremely long periods of time and satisfy woman after woman after woman. And you would think,
well, that just came out of left field.
That's probably
that was getting really
hella
deep.
Frustrating.
I was like, this is going to be like something I'm going to learn about here, and then it hit us.
Yeah, the guy's he's a Michael Douglas of the 39s.
All of us right now, like our jaws are literally like on the table going, where the hell did that go?
Well, it came from, I thought, okay, I'm not going to give you the whole thing because I think I'll bore the crap. No, I'm going to give you the whole thing. Okay, so I thought, okay, well, he's got gills so he can breathe. He can breathe underwater, which means he can hold his breath for a long period of time, or he can breathe underwater, which means he probably could satisfy a woman for just forever. So why is he such a dick? Why is he so upset? Like, he could have any woman he wants and over and over and over again. And then I thought of Kevin
Smith.
No, I thought of Kevin. I thought of Waterworld, where the dude has gills in the back of his ears.
Okay.
Costner. And I'm like, no wonder he's aggravated because nobody gets that he's so good at this. I would be a dick too. I'd be like, dude, he's the best cunnilinguist in the entire planet and gets no recognition for it. That would piss me off too.
Maybe it's because there's no girls with girls.
Oh my God. That's the reason. Cause all the mermaids have fish bottoms. He's insane. That's it. He's insane. Just like the Human Torch is insane because his father sunk him in a concrete tomb
for his adolescence.
For his entire adolescence, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't touch himself. No wonder the dude's nuts.
Shit.
You think I'm joking? I'm being totally serious.
All these guys are just sexually repressed.
Maybe that's part of it, but I'm just saying you got to be. I mean, okay.
So you're saying that all the battles are just out of sexual frustration?
Yeah. Well, you don't see everything that happens during the battles, but yes.
Shit. You know, look at the Hulk. Every time he gets pissed off, just rages and starts hitting things.
At some point, the Hulk was in the bathroom.
Somebody knocked.
And so his mother was knocking on the door. Hulk, come on. What's taking so long? And eventually the Hulk got mad. And he's like, you know, it's the Hulk. So he'll rub it as long as he wants. And he finally figured it out. I mean, you know, but there's none of that in this. Anyway, we got off topic a little bit, but I'm just saying.
A little bit?
That's probably why. Rewrite the Marvel Universe tonight.
That's probably
guys.
Why the Submariner is such a dick. Because I would be a dick too. Shit. Anyway, so.
Understandable.
Can we just talk for a second about the art?
Yes.
I was amazed.
That was a great segue. You know, best. Completely like left field, off the walls.
Yeah.
Well, now let's talk about how great the art is.
Let me just interrupt my rant for a second here.
Let me interrupt myself real quick.
I was done.
So about the art. Gorgeous.
Was it just amazing? It looked like Norman Rockwell had done a comic
book. The whole
book.
Way through. Yeah.
It was so beautiful and so
you can
well
see why
done.
There were $6 a piece back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
This was really what broke Alex Ross is, you know, to become one of the most popular comic artists there is. Before this, he had done a Terminator miniseries.
That's it?
Yeah, that was...
Was it in the same sort of style?
It was painted, yeah, but it... I mean, so, like, going from Terminator to... Something that we're still talking about almost 20 years later.
Yeah. There's something about the way that he draws everybody that just grounds it somehow. I don't want to say makes it more realistic, but the fabric feels like fabric. Everything isn't slippery and shiny and fake looking. Everything has this just grounded tangibility that you almost feel like you...
Did you read any of the back matter that he has?
Yeah, the one back matter. He had like all of his friends posing.
That was awesome.
Yeah. Great.
I never even thought... That was a huge... Like, I was like, artists do that?
Oh, hell
wow.
Yeah.
I'm not an artist.
Dude, my phone has so many ridiculous pictures of me. You don't even understand. It's like, I'll bet you do the same thing, Marcus.
Well, I get my friends to make fun of me for when I'm drawing because all my characters don't really have human bodies, but they have a lot of facial expressions. So while I'm drawing,
You're making funny faces?
Yeah, I'm making funny faces the entire time. And then right. I take a picture with my phone. And then
yep, exactly. I've got all awesome. Wacky that's ass awesome. Pictures of myself. Yeah.
Like, you don't know how that's such an amazing thing to do for your craft. And I never even thought, like, for a minute I was like, oh, that's cheating. But then I was like, oh, that's
no.
brilliant.
No, that is, yeah.
That's brilliant. That's so
that,
excellent.
And I just quick side note, that is probably one of the biggest missteps of a lot of starting out art or a lot of new artists is not using reference enough. Reference is the bread and butter of any serious artist. And yeah, eventually you get to where you don't need it as much, but if you don't know how to draw it, you don't just go, I'll just try. You find out. And that's how that works with
really
anything.
A relief, because I can spend a long time trying to figure out a particular pose. And had I just used a reference from the beginning, I would have been done. I could have moved on to the next
thing. It's actually faster. Whereas at first you're thinking like, oh, I got to get the camera out. And I got to get somebody to make this pose for me. And man, it's like, no, dude, it's 10 times faster. 10 times faster to just take a shot and go bang. And you're done. And you're moving on.
Well, one of the things that I didn't know they did when they do pinup girls, like back in the day, there was some post somewhere where they had all of these pictures of pinup girls and then it would show you the pinup girl and then it would show you what they actually painted. And I was like, what? Like somebody didn't just...
It's all like, from reference.
You know, and I was like, well, that is amazing. That's such a great idea.
Yeah, so. this book actually has almost that painted pinup girl look in places.
Right.
Yeah.
Well.
The art is so fantastic. And he was saying at the end, like John was saying in the back matter, using watercolor and gouache paints and airbrush were the mediums that he used, that he mentioned anyway. And I'm not sure I've ever seen a comic that is more striking and beautiful in its artistic composition. It's just ridiculous.
I think it's as beautiful as what I've seen in like Saga, but in a different way. And just one more thing, when you said it had this tangibility to it, when you're reading this, you really get the sense of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And I think part of that is maybe what his strategy was as an artist to draw it this way or to paint
it this way.
It's
got a lot to do with the palette. It has a lot to do with the hairstyles. It has a lot to do with the clothes and the cars and everything.
Well researched.
Incredible amount of research went into all this.
Reading it, it's probably the first time I've read it in about 7 or 8 years. And I'm reading it, I'm going, wow, this is like Madman now.
Right.
Yeah.
As it's going through the years, they clip to a new one, and it's like, that's very clearly this time period. That's clearly that time period.
Yeah.
One scene, the hairstyles, the clothes, everything, it just communicates so much.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, moving on to the next issue.
Yeah.
Where do we leave off? We're moving to issue 3.
Well, basically, issue one dealt with 39 through the early 40s, and then we get a big jump with issue 2 into the early 60s. So, we went from when Marvel Comics started out in 39 to when actually Marvel Comics became the thing with Fantastic Four number 1 in 63, and that kind of started on the Marvels.
Right, and now Phil is not a young whippersnapper anymore.
Yeah, it's 20 years later, and
he's got kids.
So it's gone, and I liked how Marvel's, it kept with the time period when the comics actually came out.
Yeah.
So we went from the 30s to now it looks like the early 60s, when the early Marvel stuff started with issue 2. It didn't like try to jump into current day time to have this.
I thought it was really amazing to see the old costume designs and character designs and have them work so well in this art style. Because you see the old comics and some of the costumes look, I mean, dated and silly. And here they still have that look a little bit, but they're very accurately drawn to the original style and character designs, but somehow they don't seem as goofy, you know? It doesn't have that sort of like, oh, this is a very silly looking character design. Now, somehow when they're drawn in this fashion, it's like, I didn't bat an eye. You just go, okay, that's what that character looks like. And you just keep on going.
It made me think of the Watchmen movie on the clip where they showed the 50s and actually showed the guys in their old uniforms. It was like, that looks like what it would look like in the comic books. And I appreciate that they didn't go with like black leather and, you know, modern time things.
They did the dated costumes, on purpose. And it works really well.
So issue 2 deals with the mutant problem. And one of the things I've never understood about Marvel Comics is Spider-Man's okay. You know, The Avengers are okay, but just because the X-Men were born with these extra powers, they're feared. Well, why isn't, you know, Spider-Man feared or Thor or...
I think that it's because less that it's going to make real logical sense if, you know, why these and not these, or why are these guys treated different than these guys? Because essentially, functionally, they're pretty much going to be as different from normal humans as, you know, like mutants are pretty much as different as normal humans as Spider-Man is, you know, that kind of thing. But the thing is that mutants were created to be an allegory about, you know, race relations and prejudices and things like that. And that's the narrative point of the mutants in the first place. And I mean, and so it's like, but you're right. It does create sort of an odd disconnect.
It's always been the disconnect for me is I can even understand, like, say, the Morlock type mutants where they're so disfigured.
Sure.
But for the most part, Marvel Girl and the Beast look like normal humans, you know, except Beast had big feet at the time.
Sure. Yeah.
What I caught from it is that the mutant issue was a deeper extension of this inferiority complex that Phil Sheldon had in the beginning. So now it's really driven home that these people are the next stage of evolution.
Yeah, that's great.
Like now,
that's good, Joe.
Humans are, they're not just...
These aren't just some strange alien creatures from another place or another planet. Or
you just, they're not just not measuring up.
Yeah, us humans are on our way
they're
out.
Fucking obsolete.
Yeah.
Like we are yesterday's news now.
That's great.
Like you get over the shock of the supers, right? The Marvels, rather. And now
but
this
they're
comes
removed
up.
From humanity. You're safe. They're a separate thing. They can compartmentalize them and that, you know, whatever it is that they do that's different than us and however we deal with them, eventually they become part of our life, a way of life. They're just part of things.
And it's perfect
that they're separate.
It's perfect that it happens in the 60s, which is the heat, you know, it's the sort of the epicenter of the race issues in the United States. But
when Kirby and Stan Lee created the X-Men, it was to be an allegory for like race relations.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
There's a lot of stuff in comic books, and especially a lot of stuff in fantasy novels in particular, mm-hmm. and sci-fi fantasy especially. There's a lot of stuff that deals directly with social issues mm-hmm. in a very, for the time, often a very sort of loud and outspoken way that would never get by in a fictional modern time story. If they actually said, these people are persecuting these people because of the color of their skin or because of their ancestry in New York at this time in our world, and it takes place in an exact copy of our modern times, a lot of the time those sort of stories would get shut down. But when you're talking about mutants with special powers or aliens from another planet, it's like all of a sudden, for some reason, the editors are like, let it go through, who cares? But if you're willing to read between the lines, mm-hmm. it still has a lot to say about how horrible we can be to each other right. and things that are just wrong in our society.
That's what I really liked in here was, at the beginning, Phil Sheldon, you know, basically joins a mob that's attacking the X-Men.
Yeah, he chucks a brick before
I know it, brick's in my hand. And
yeah. And then later on in the story, he thinks that his kids are stealing table scraps to give to a stray dog. Well, it turns out it's not a stray dog. It's this little girl that they found who's a mutant and is hiding in their basement.
And unfortunately for her, looks very different.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no denying that she's not human.
Yes.
And just him realizing, wait, she's just a little girl. You know, she's really no different than my two daughters that are here. And he realizes, you know, how wrong he's been on.
It's
on
a paradigm shift for
it's
him.
It's another stage in Phil's growth as a person.
Right, right.
That is, which is often, or at this in these books, always the catalyst for which is all the Marvels. You know, be they X-Men or whatever. You know, mutants or normal Marvels or whatever. And did you guys notice that the young mutant girl that his daughters were hiding, that they never went into any of her abilities, that it was had nothing to do with that. Nobody knew. They didn't even do it.
She
in
may
passing.
Not have even had any.
She may not have even had any abilities. She was simply, because she was a mutant, and all they did was they dealt with the social ramifications of that. They never went at all into her abilities, which is typically kind of first on the plate. It's sort of the first thing that you go into. It's like, this person is a mutant and they can do this. And this is, it's like traditionally. And this, it's like, it's nothing about that. It pinpoints that whole mutant controversy narrative, which is so cool.
She was just a mutant, shows up in his house. Now it's in his front door. It's you know, it's something that he has to deal with, and it could be really, really bad. And it was, again, like I said, it was a paradigm shift for him. All of a sudden, they're really not that bad. Why do we have this perception of them? But I did think it was funny because you've got these two guys, you know, in the previous issue that are destroying the city. And then you have these mutants that aren't really doing anything. They're just different. They're just different enough. And, you know, until you said that, and now it makes a lot more sense to me what the theme of those were. But I always thought, it's so weird. Like, why do they let, you know, the Human Torch and Namor get away with all this destruction? And they, like, you know, they give them plaques and awards and all this stuff. Or, you know, they sort of laud them as superheroes. But then these guys who are really doing, you know, the dirty work as well.
They're doing good in spite of being mistreated by the population.
Yeah. Exactly. And they, you know, they're sort of, they treat them horribly. So makes a lot more sense.
There's always something beneath the surface, or at least there should be anyway.
Any other thoughts on issue two?
One of the last scenes is really just heart-wrenching, where he comes home after the news shows the Sentinels coming in and like busting everything up. And he's running home to, you know, try and protect his family.
Yeah.
And he finds the note from the little mutant girl.
On the worst possible night, too.
Yeah.
Right. Where she's like, I, you know, thank you, but...
And when he says, and we never figured out what happened to her. Oh, tore my friggin' heart out, man. Yeah.
Dear Mr. Sheldon.
Yeah.
Thank you for everything, but I have to leave. I do not want your family to get hurt because of me. I took some food. Thank you for the new clothes. Love, Maggie. And then literally, you know...
Like we drawn never, in crayon with incorrect spelling.
I know.
Just a little kid.
Yeah.
Just a little girl, you know. And she knew. And it's sad. You hope that, you know, she came back sometime in the future, but it doesn't happen. So.
Yeah, the story was very, very, very heartfelt.
It was really odd because right at that moment, it seemed like somebody was chopping onions in my office.
And then moving on for issue three, that takes us to the late 60s time of Marvel. So we've kind of jumped ahead about 4 or 5 years in Marvel continuity. And it basically is dealing, you know, the Avengers are in full swing, the Fantastic Four is in full swing, Iron Man's doing his thing, the Hulk's doing his thing.
Spider-Man's around.
Yeah, Spider-Man's around. And we get to take on probably the most famous big early Marvel cosmic event, the coming of the Silver Surfer and Galactus, and how that affected everyone's perception. And basically, this was the first time in Marvel where there was basically the whole world could be destroyed by Galactus. And I loved the initial thing where everybody's, you know, scared, terrified, what's going on. And then when it gets taken care of, how everyone's like, well, it must have been a hoax. And they're ashamed about how scared they were about it.
Now, I think this was kind of a take on what happened in the early 70s after the Vietnam War, when all the soldiers started coming back and the heavy protesting, the
baby burners or whatever.
Yeah, everyone hated the soldiers, even though they just, you know, went and risked their lives for the past however many years and, you know, came back, you know, hard and broken people, and everyone's giving them shit for doing it. You know, most of them never asked to be sent over there.
God, I never thought of that. You are brilliant, because that's exactly, I feel like now listening to you say that, it's exactly what it is.
Yeah, the Avengers are out there in space battling the Kree-Skrull War, and they come back and everyone's like, yeah, whatever. Well, thanks a lot, assholes.
And this would have put that around the time. This would have been about 67, 68, 69.
And this is really one of the first times where Phil starts to have a different moral compass and way of interacting with the Marvels or thinking about the Marvels than most other people. Because up until then, he had been kind of going with the flow. Even with the mutants thing going on, all the way until he met the young girl, which obviously was, I would say, a big turning point for him. He was sort of unknowingly or unwittingly caught up in the fury of it all, you know, with attacking the X-Men when they showed up and everything. And, you know, starting with a little girl, he starts to have a different opinion than the population. But then now, with these big, you know, cosmic events going on and people not appreciating and mistreating the Marvels, he starts to get outspoken. He yells at somebody in a train station or on a train or a bus or something like that. And, you know, people are just talking smack as they do. And he's like, you should, and he gets mad at them, you know, and he starts to just be like, man, what is wrong with
what's
with
it going to take the world to actually end before you appreciate what these people are doing with everybody?
Yeah. I mean, they've saved us without even being asked, without even being prompted. We're taking him for granted. Mm-hmm. And he kind of decides, look, I need to start speaking out. I need to do something to balance the scales.
And this really sets off the trajectory for the rest of the Marvel story.
But also, one of the things that I put in my notes was that the media sort of over-sensationalizes all of the bad stuff.
It focuses on all the negative.
Right? Because that's what sells papers. That's what sells commercials. That's what sells whatever it is.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Right? And
that's a good one.
If it bleeds, it leads. And so I thought that was an interesting overall arch, because that's now taking what I just said about the over sensationalism of negative and taking what Joe said, which is you sort of have this, all of the military coming back from Vietnam War and sort of all the negativity from, you know, so they're the cultural revolution against sort of, right? One of the reasons why that happened was because this was the first televised war. And so you have, and actually it makes a lot of sense that you would have that happening. To first televised war, you actually see atrocity happening in front of you. It's not something that you hear on the radio. It's not something that you, maybe if you're lucky, you see a picture of, you know, a graveyard of dead bodies in Life magazine. You're actually seeing soldiers in color, I think, if I remember correctly, torching villages and people dying and lime pit bodies and things like that.
You have the public who's more well-informed now and moving into a potentially less jingoistic time, you know?
What does that mean? What do you mean jingoistic?
Jingoism nationalist is like seriously, it's like super, super hyper, like America woo.
Okay, you know? Super hyper patriotic.
I hadn't thought of this, but a nice parallel is in 39, you know, the Nazis really were, you know, your classic, you know, mustache twirling,
snidely whiplash,
villain. I mean, they're Adolf Hitler. I mean, that was, you know, he literally looked like a supervillain.
Yeah.
And that's why so many of these comics got started there, you know, Good versus Evil, because it was so black and white for World War II. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the Marvel thing moved on. You know, we talk about coming back from Vietnam. You know, no one really understood what that war was about. You know, and I still ask my dad, you know, what was the Vietnam War about? You know, you got drafted. He's like, I still have no idea why they wanted to send us over there. I think it's a lot of the thing, and that's kind of where you can see even the comic shifting was, what are these ideas? We're questioning authority, you know, and from there.
Yeah, it's great because the way that this comic displays the general population of America, obviously, because that's the lens for which we look, it totally grows and changes and is in harmony with the times and how, the non-comic world, the real world, reacted or would have reacted to those sort of situations. And, you know, you see early on, you see the Torch and Namor fighting the Nazis in the theater, and everybody's like, yeah, you go get them, boys. Yeah, those are our guys. Stars and Stripes. Yeehaw! And then you get later on into this, and it's not just fighting humans, it's saving the entire Earth from destruction. And they're like, me, 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 me. And it's like a completely different time.
That was the scene I loved on issue 3 was when Phil Sheldon's walking home and he sees everyone outside the church and people are listening on the radio to see what's going on. And you see this older African-American guy. And he says, just find Captain America. They find Captain America and this will all turn out all right. I've seen that man fight in the war one time. He'll straighten it all out. Just find the man. You know, and that one, it hit like...
Oh, yeah.
No, you know, because the older people, you know, still into the heroes.
Still have the faith.
And have the faith.
Not cynical. Not doubting.
Definitely generational, cultural changes over time, over the decades. Totally. So,
and then the other thing I really liked in issue 3 was earlier in the book, it showed Phil who was very preoccupied with work. And then towards the end of the issue, when he realizes the world is about ready to end, all he cared about was getting home to his family.
Right.
To be with them that one last time.
You know, between 3 and 4, I actually found another theme. Because is it 3 where are they at the zoo in 3 or is that 4?
That's 3.
Okay. So in 3, they're at the zoo and he's with his family, but you know, he's not really there. And then later on in 3 or early on in 4, they're like playing Monopoly and he's playing games with his kids and he's all inside of his head. And I thought that there was another parallelism with how we're talking about starting in the 40s starting in 39 and then you're in the 60s and everything that's going on, right? Now we're like in 3, you're in the late 60s and then 4 is kind of early 70s or 80s, right? And like how technology is changing us.
4 is 75.
Okay, so 75. We're starting to become far more plugged in, even in 75, you know, radio and phone and television is all more common. Now there's a television in every home. And he's a content producer, right? So, you know, I saw it as, you know, it's a parallel. There's a little bit of parallel to how we are always thinking about, you know, what you're going to be doing next. Like, he's never there. He wasn't really there until he realizes, you know, geez, this could be the last moment. But, you know, again, he's at the zoo and he's like, oh, well, you know, I should be there taking pictures. Or, you know, he's playing Monopoly with his kids again and he loses. And he's like, well, that's all right. I had work to do anyway. You know, he wasn't really there in spirit. He was just there playing with his kids.
Right,
and so I saw that as sort of like, we're always in our head. And I get, for me, it hit me because I'm like, you know, I'll be cooking dinner with my daughter. But because I work in IT, my phone could be buzzing in my pocket and I'm thinking, okay, who's this email from? What, you know, what is it that I'm going to have to work on now at 7 o'clock at night? Is this an emergency, right? I can never shut down. Questions. It's commented very, very early on that Iron Man didn't build his suit.
They didn't know that Tony Stark
was Iron Man. Okay. Yeah. So I had that moment where I was like, oh, he hasn't announced it yet. So they don't know who this is. Yeah. Okay.
In fact, it wasn't announced until maybe like 3 or 4 years ago.
So then I got angry.
Okay.
And here's why. I got angry because the Iron Man of this period is far more impressive than the Iron Man in the movies. Because the Iron Man in the movies, Robert Downey Jr., who plays him great, because, you know, he's like the Iron Man that has all the technology you could possibly have. He has stuff that we don't even have in 2012 and 2013.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, this guy built this suit in, you know, what I'm assuming is
1963,
and he has all this amazing technology, and he's a normal guy, super, super smart, but he's out there competing with superheroes. That, to me, made him so much cooler. Like, I was like, why did they...
And I also like the idea that he didn't come right out and be like, well, I'm Iron Man. It's like such an incredibly egotistical move, and it's so, it's nice to you know, have an Iron Man in a, you know, to be able to enjoy a comic where Iron Man is really more of a hero, really more of, you know, like,
he's more
humble. I think it shows the generational thing, you know, and how comics were in the 60s versus in 2013, you know, 45 years later, you wouldn't believe someone would, I'm going to keep this secret. You know,
I've heard people say that, you know, even in the movies in particular, talking about, I think it was the Avengers movie, saying how, you know, Steve Rogers, Captain America, is really a snapshot of the hero of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie's version of Stark and Iron Man is easily a snapshot of what is what is like personified, sought after, filled in magazines full of, all over television. That's the kind of personality,
celebrity.
That's the kind of celebrity. That's the kind of thing that our culture focuses on.
He's egotistic. He's
rich, wealthy. I mean, wealthy, intelligent, globetrotting, always with the girls. You know, all that messing around. You know, all that sort of stuff. And it's not. There's an attraction to that instead of an attraction to wholesome hero virtue.
Until he's intelligent, I was like, he's Paris Hilton.
Well, I mean, in the book, he is described as a bit of a playboy. But not to the extent
and
that
originally he's an alcoholic. And
oh, I didn't know that.
That came in the late 70s, the alcoholism. But I mean, he was a, you know, a playboy, philanthropist, engineer, ran a company kind of thing. That was what Tony Stark did.
I guess what I was saying is that, you know, Tony Stark in general fits modern culture better. Than
modern pop culture,
modern pop would fit into our modern pop culture.
Very self-absorbed,
much better than some of the traditional superheroes.
Yeah.
The other thing I love is how there was a look of complete fear on your faces because you guys thought I was going to do another Namor.
No, it's like now if Steve Jobs were to have built an Iron Man suit and gone off and fought crime, that would be like, yeah, okay, that's cool. But if it was Paris Hilton nowadays, I would be like, whoa, good for you, Paris. Turn your shit around and do it right.
She couldn't even ride a mini motorcycle down down a red carpet.
I don't get this whole people are famous for being famous thing.
Yeah, it's so weird. Oh, wait. It's our culture. You know what he would be if it was Steve Jobs? It'd be Iron Man.
No. Iron Man.
There you go.
It's a thing now.
I Apple Man.
It's awful. It's really awful.
I've heard that Apple's going to buy Idaho to make it, you know,
I Potato. I Spuds.
Awful.
I
so
Spud.
On to issue 5?
Issue four. And this was actually one of my favorites because it moved from the Lee Kirby of the 60s. In the early 70s, where it's basically the second generation of Marvel creators took over. John Romita was doing the art for Spider-Man, and then later on into Gil Kane, who actually did the death of Gwen Stacy that this dealt on. And it, to me, that was really when it felt like the innocence of the comics ended. That was the first big major death in a comic. You know, Spider-Man's girlfriend completely out of the blue dying. And I think that's where it really changed to become the more world and grim and grittier thing that we got later.
Which makes sense because Phil had been around for all this previous stuff, and that was his time when he was young and in his prime. And now moving into this time where there's this loss of innocence, all of a sudden he eventually towards the end of the book decides to retire. And it's almost like he's a man at a time in this new world. And he's sort of, you know, his antique ideas of what the Marvels are and what they represent for the world and the sort of comfort that he takes in them, always going to save everybody, and, you know, has this complete and total faith in them. And then it's rocked when Stacy dies.
And we're starting to see a new breed of hero. They show us Luke Cage introduced.
Right.
And
Black Widow has her sexy outfit now.
Yeah.
Now, did Gwen know that he was Spider-Man?
No, not at all.
No. Okay. She didn't you tell me once, Joe, that she died hating Spider-Man?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
Because Peter Parker always chased him around. It was like him or her, right?
That would be my guess. And she blamed Spider-Man for her father's death.
Which is interesting because they went a different way in this.
Yeah, in the book. That's one of the reasons.
Originally.
Early on.
Yeah, early on, she blamed her for the death.
Right.
And gradually she got to understand that Spider-Man wasn't the cause of it.
Man, that scene in the jail at Ron and Riker's with Doc Ock was awesome.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever seen a character, because I mean, objectively, Doc Ock, if you just saw him, just a character design of him without his arms and all that, he just looks like some
squat little dude.
Yeah, little guy, bowl cut, squinty eyes, round glasses. Like, he doesn't seem that intimidating. And that's what he is when he's in Rikers. Obviously, he doesn't have his arms, otherwise, he wouldn't still be in Rikers. But he emanated this sense of power and evil that was palpable. And it was really neat to have that. I think the scene where he leans back and smiles and says, you know, why should I help clear his name? It's more enjoyable to watch Spider-Man, you know, squirm.
I'm watching
and it's just like, dang. He just seems so dark. They communicated such a depth of just darkness in that character in those couple panels. It was very cool.
I always thought he looked like Elton John.
Yes.
A little bit.
Oh my gosh. That's funny.
That's who should have played.
Like a cross between Stephen King and Elton John. He looks a little Stephen King-y in here to me.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
Basically, Phil witnesses Gwen's death, and that's the thing that makes him basically be done with his photography.
Yeah, he's finished. He spends some time afterwards processing it. Kind of goes into hibernation almost. Shuts down, really. There were several scenes of him sitting at home with his family, hanging out, and his wife was trying to mobilize him to get up and do some work, which is totally different from her normal state of being. His kids were like, "Daddy, Daddy, let's play." And his assistant now was trying to, you know, try and pull him out of this funk. And he was just detached. He was just broken.
Well, I mean, he had spent time with her because he was trying to clear Spider-Man's name at this point.
Yeah, right. And he was basically planning his second book. Right.
Yeah. And so, and again,
he felt like clearing Spider-Man's name was his way to contribute and change the public opinion and understanding.
Well, it became
to become more
work.
In alignment with his own thoughts because he feels like everybody was mistreating the Marvels so much. And he's like, this is the way. This is how I can change people's thinking. I can prove Spider-Man's innocence. I can put it in a book. I can use Gwen Stacy, the daughter of the man he supposedly killed. I can use Captain Stacy's personal, what was it? He had like a book
journal.
I can use that and all that information. And I can, you know, I can, what do they call it? Vindicate? No.
Vindicate. Yeah. That's the word.
Yeah. I can vindicate him. Like, that's the plan. I'll use that, and that'll be his big... It was kind of his, like, big whammy. He was going to use that, and that was going to be his book, and that was going to be his mark on the world.
I really liked how he disliked Peter Parker, because
Peter kept bringing in all the bad. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
because Peter was just exploiting him and totally playing up, like, I got some good shots of that damn Spider-Man for you, Jameson.
But it was him taking shots of himself.
Right. Exactly. So funny. What a racket.
The way I read it was, the moment she dies, it wasn't about the... I don't think that I feel like it was as much about Spider-Man's inability to save her, which sort of deflates your thought process on how omnipotent superheroes tend to seem to be. I think it was because he was so close, because he does make this comment about, you know, you can't see it when you're on the inside. You can only see it when you're on the outside. I think he was so close. I think that it was heartbreaking. This was the thing that broke this, you know, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And that's what sort of shut him down, was this broke his heart. And it wasn't because necessarily that she died. It was because she died and it was a major event in his life, but it was just another blip on the radar and the rest of the world. The world ground on. The world. Another superhero was born. Another supervillain was born. People died. And it wasn't anything to anybody. You know? They were more interested in the wedding of two superheroes than this wonderful, amazing, beautiful young woman dying who was herself innocent. The whole point of, you know, the Marvels themselves was that they protect the innocent with no... They ask for nothing in return. It's totally unreciprocated. Even if we, you know, we totally disregard them and we persecute them, they still do it.
Yeah, there was a scene where he says, I get it. The Marvels are not there for all of the people talking smack. The Marvels are not there for all the people that are complaining, you know, or the news or anything like that. The Marvels are there. They do what they do for Gwen, for people like her,
right,
for the innocent people. That's why they do it. That's the whole deal. That's the whole point of it all. Where for so long he felt like, how can they keep doing what they do and being so underappreciated and everything like that? And he finally, through her, sees someone who's so purely innocent and says, I get it. Right. That's their entire purpose. I took away something really interesting from this, I think, because I was trying to, as I often do when I come to the end of a book, I try and understand the message. I assert that good writing often comes with an underlying theme or communication that the author is trying to share with the reader or the viewer. And so I was in the car this afternoon running some errands and thinking, what is the meaning in this? And, you know, I think there's several, like Justin had already suggested, there's several different meanings, there's several different things you could take away that are, you know, alluded to or not so much said blatantly, but definitely are themes in the book. But I think that my takeaway from this final issue and looking back at the previous issues is that it's all about Phil's slowly growing in his understanding of the Marvels. And if you look at the earlier issues, he has this very polarized black and white, or the world at large has a very polarized black and white. They're great or they're terrible, right? They're going to save us all or they're out to get us. There's this, it's one or the other, black or white. Mm-hmm. There's not this gray area. There's not this humanity. There's not this fallibility. He spends so much time separating them from humanity, separating them from everybody else and all their little mistakes and, you know, problems and ups and downs in life. They spend so much time putting them in this, on this pedestal, and putting them polar opposite. Either they're good or they're bad. They're helping us or they're hurting us. They try and put so much on them. They try and make them so simplified somehow, and simplified in purpose and meaning and aim. And he kind of goes back and forth. You know, at first he doesn't like them at all. They're just bad. I don't like them. And then he starts to come into like, well, you know, they're all good. They're great, you know. And then with the mutants comes a more complex understanding of how they fit into society and all that. But then in this final one, where he's come to a place where he's expecting them to win and always protect and you know, virtue and everything's going to work out and that they'll save you. And he just thinks of them as like a safety net, really. And when it doesn't work out, finally, there's this, oh, well, really, they're just people, you know? Like, I that was kind of my takeaway from that final chapter, was that so much of the book spends so much time making this big separation between the Marvels and humanity. But in this final book, it kind of comes full circle and it's like, man, they're just human. They're just, you know, they're fallible. They can make mistakes, you know? That he had to admit that there's a rich tapestry of gray area that all of this exists in. And that he couldn't have the simple thinking of, you know, they're no good and they challenge my strength and confidence and being able to take care of my family and who I am as a man, all the way to they're great and everybody's so mean to them and I think that I need to be a champion for their cause. He moves all the way to, man, they're just people. People with power, sure. People with mutations, sure. But they're not good or bad or right or wrong. They're just people. And that was sort of my, I don't know, big takeaway from this final one.
So are you saying that at the end he sort of was like, there's nothing marvelous about them at all? Or
I think that the final interaction with Spider-Man and Gwen Stacy, I think it was his final lesson in his, you know, kind of ever-growing understanding of who these people are and how they fit into our world. And it was one last challenge to his thinking, because it totally blew him away. He had said a couple things when he was watching her, or watching the whole battle between Goblin and Spider-Man with Gwen Stacy mixed up in the middle of it. He had this confidence that it would all work out.
Right.
You know, there was not a doubt in his mind. He was like, oh no, not her. But he had this like, but I knew that he would save her. I knew that it would all work out. I think it was just the final layer of like, you know, it's not simple. It's not black and white. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading into it too much, but that's just,
I think that's pretty close to what was going in the, in the book.
Because each of the chapters, each of the issues educates Phil and helps him to grow and change as a person in his understanding of the marbles and in his place in comparison to them and just kind of the world at large. It changes his world perspective every time. Mm-hmm. Every time he's introduced to a new challenge to his thinking and has to grow. And this was, I think, the final challenge, the final piece that he needed to still grow and stop having this simplistic thinking of there's good and bad and, you know, let the gray areas only for the humans. You know,
many people consider the death of Gwen Stacy the end of the Silver Age of comics. Mm-hmm. And then what's come after that to be Bronze Age and then the Modern Age. And I think that's where you're going with it is,
yeah,
you know, instead of being infallible and they'll always save the day is they're humans, you know, they have feet of clay like everyone else.
I had a special takeaway from this book, the main character being a photojournalist. I worked mm-hmm. as a photojournalist briefly. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
There is just this strange fugue state that you exist in, being immersed in something and still being an outsider. That you see things that nobody else sees, but you're still not seeing it the way that the people actually in the event see it. And it's a wild way to experience something, because no one else... This is probably why he got so much, I guess, derision... Watching the populace say, oh, yeah, they suck, or hey, they saved us again, yay. And just couldn't understand it because he was so close without being in it that really there's no way to describe. God, I'm really trying the best I can to figure out how to tell you guys. If you've ever like hung out with a friend who's really into something that you're kind of, okay. Like, Justin, if you've ever gone to a punk show, not a metal show, like, the people there, it's so close, you understand what's going on, but it's still just on the periphery of what you understand.
Right, so you can, I mean, I can understand why, you know, somebody's into something, even if I'm not into it. I get the sort of edification of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're trying to describe is... You're close enough to be a witness to it, but not have a sense of its actual real impact because you're just far enough away. You're, you know what? It reminds me of this story. There's a photographer who took an incredibly famous picture of a little African baby moments before his malnutrition baby, and there were vultures around it. I'm sure you've all seen the picture.
Yeah,
it was in Time and Life. Yeah. And later on, he was asked, why didn't you do something to save the child? And he said, my job was to tell the story, to photograph. The photograph was more, you know, it's like it did more than I could have ever done. And the child dies shortly after. This same, he actually eventually committed suicide because the weight of it was so heavy on him that he never did anything for that child. But what he'll never, ever get was that suddenly the entire world saw the plight of the third world country. And one child that he didn't save, he's saved innumerable other children because of that. And that's what you're trying, I think, to describe is he was right there in the thick of it for a lot of it. As a matter of fact, he was injured because of it. He was that mm-hmm. close. But he wasn't... He was still an outsider to all of it that was going on.
You don't get to be a part of the event, and you don't get to be one of the witnesses of the event. You're what connects them.
Okay, exactly.
You're like a conduit to everybody.
You're not
else.
A participant. You're the relay. So, yeah.
Interesting.
And that's a hard place to be. And it's no wonder that it took that huge toll on him.
I always enjoy when a comic takes the perspective of someone who is trying to get the story of what actually happened. You know, whether it's a news person, whether it's somebody writing a memoir. I can remember back to when we were talking about the Pacific Rim book, and the perspective of the main character was somebody who was supposed to be, I think, writing an article on everything that had happened with the Jaegers and all the kaiju.
A recount, right?
And it was brilliant because it allowed for it to be from the perspective of one character, but you could get to see almost an omniscient level of information. But at the same time, it still fit into the confines of we're following this protagonist. So it's nice because it ties you very clearly to a protagonist, and it's not this you know, oh, godlike perspective on everything. But it allows you to see everything you could possibly want to see, because that's the purpose in that in of this person. It's their job. It's their life, is to get the story, you know. And so it works really well for that to be your protagonist. I think it's a really, really cool protagonist to have.
Yeah. Well, that just about wraps up our thoughts on Marvels tonight. We went a little long, so we're going to save Astro City for next week. From the sounds of it, is I think all of us really enjoyed the book.
Mm.
I was, you know, very happy to read it again after probably about 7 or 8 years and getting back to how much I really enjoyed the book. So, I mean, I guess that we give it a probably the highest recommendation we've given, you know, along with Saga and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And check it out if you guys get a chance.
Yeah. This is masterful. It's not just another comic book.
And it's next, masterful. Yeah. Next week, we're going to get into Astro City, which continues Kurt Busiek's take on, you know, the everyman and how they view superheroes.
Yeah, what did he say in the foreword? He was saying he's interested in what's happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
Not what's happening, you know, like, because he talks so much about everybody's so busy trying to deconstruct, you know, the superheroes or trying to put the superheroes and make them more realistic or something. And he's like, let's just let them exist in the world they exist in. But I'm curious what happens to the little man that lives down the street. Yeah. You know, or the guy that works at the grocery store, not the superheroes, but in the superhero world, what happens elsewhere? Because it's a full, rich, living, breathing world. It's very
Alex Ross didn't continue doing the interiors, he does do all the covers in Astro City, and he does do all the character designs.
And the covers on every Astro City have been
beautiful.
Awesome.
Want poster.
So, John, let me just ask. I know we're running long, but JP and I, We spoke a lot this episode, but what was it for you that you really loved about this comic?
It's probably the only one here that picked it up when it came in, you know, came out.
Like day one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was so different from what was coming out at the time. And it was a love letter to Marvel Comics from like 1960 to 75.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good at the time when everything was cool, K-E-W-L, you know, the 90s cool, to revisit something that was so pure and actually good storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And
amazing art.
Yeah, and amazing art. And
it's aged incredibly well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for something that's 20 years
old. I didn't know it was
old,
that old. Yeah. I did not know it was that old. I thought, oh, a year ago.
Well, I mean, because the stories that it talks about are pretty timeless themselves.
Right. Too, so. Well, cool. Good. I'm glad.
So next week, Astro City.
Next week, Astro City. Probably the first two volumes.
That's right.
Final reminder, go and help Marcus fund Mallow Man. Go to Kickstarter.com, type in Mallow Man in the search bar.
Pledge if you can. If you can't, share it on Facebook or any other social media. I really appreciate it.
And if you want to swing down, we have all 4 issues in stock downstairs.
Yeah. It's a good read. Highly recommended.
I love bacon.
Later, Gator.
I love bacon.
It wasn't until we did the Saga episode until I realized why John likes the Marvels so much. It's because on the very first page, without even having to look for it, is the cock and balls.